This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, your 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
And so it was that Barack Obama took his place in history, joining the pantheon of fearless leaders who have piloted the ship of state through more than two centuries of stormy waters and calm.
Enshrined forever in the archives of America's history will be those great men who have guided our country to her destiny as leader of the world's free nations. Here, then, are our presidents. George Washington.
Think back to the American history lessons you had in school. Is this the way history was taught? As a cavalcade of presidents, each with his own chapter in the history book, you know, the Age of Jackson or Age of Lincoln.
Andrew Jackson, colorful old hickory, the people's president.
Each president with his own mnemonic device to keep the whole thing straight.
Grover Cleveland, only president to serve two non-consecutive terms in the White House. Benjamin Harrison.
Over the years, the March, O Presidents, has been modernized, but fundamentally it amounts to more or less the same thing. Here's the 1990s version, courtesy of the Animaniacs.
For Grover Cleveland really sat elected twice as a Democrat. Then Benjamin Harrison, after that, is William McKinley at the bat.
Teddy Roosevelt charged up San Juan Hill.
And President Taft, he got the bill.
In 1913, Woodrow Wilson takes us into World War I.
In each episode of Backstory, we rip a topic from the news and explore its historical context. Today, we're taking a closer look at the history of presidential transitions and the way we tend to think about them. As usual, I will be representing the 18th century.
While I, Ed, will be speaking for the 19th century.
And I, Brian, will be doing the heavy lifting for the 20th century. So, guys, tell me what you make of this standard storyline. You know, history kind of flows from each president's unique set of personal qualities.
Well, Brian, there's actually a technical name, if you can believe it, for that way of looking at history. It's called the presidential synthesis.
Okay, Ed, what is this presidential synthesis thing?
It sounds like something made up in a lab, doesn't it? You know,
right.
But what it really is sort of the straw man for our conversation today. Presidential synthesis is the version of American history that's taught fundamentally in our elementary and high schools and often in college, which is imagining the American history as a sequence of one presidential administration after another, each one of which is distinct from those that came before and after, like beads on a string, and that each bead is its own little piece of American history.
But
right?
That some beads matter.
Yeah, that's more right.
Than they have these surveys of who's our greatest presidents, which depend on this notion of presidential synthesis. What are the big beads?
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Important links that take us to our glorious future and connect us with our glorious past.
And our listeners know him, right? I mean, it's
just
Washington,
imagine.
Jefferson.
Washington, Jefferson, yeah. Lincoln.
Jackson.
Oh, Jackson.
You got to do Jackson.
Did you say Jackson?
Age of anybody who has their age. Anyone who has an age gets
Jackson.
In
okay,
the chain.
I was being modest for my century.
No. Do Jackson.
Even I
guess I should because I should get two. Have a whole
100 years.
I'm really going to have two great presidents.
Right.
So how many did you name?
Four.
We have four. Okay. You only get three. For the 20th century, gets three. Okay?
Oh, no. Wrong, my friend. I mean, the president matters more in the 20th century.
You know, you're right.
No, he's not.
I'm sorry, Peter. As much as I'd love to be chauvinistic about my century, the fact is that it's just hard to get too worked up about all the great contributions that James Garfield or Chester A. Arthur made. The point being that literally day in and day out, not just in episodes of high drama or international intrigue or civil war, the president has machinery behind him today that
Air Force
really,
One.
Well, yes, and the internet and, you know, all that really amplifies his influence on every aspect of our lives.
Okay, well, give us.
So we get Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And then it's Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
And then it's FDR. And then it's maybe John F. Kennedy.
No, boo.
And then it's Lyndon Johnson. And hold on to your horses.
Yeah, I know.
It's Ronald Reagan.
Right. Sure it was.
Period.
Yeah.
Sorry, Bill.
And the things in between just don't really matter that much.
That's right.
Right?
Interstitial.
And stuff doesn't happen, right?
Exactly.
To, History stands still. It's like, you know, that's when in textbooks, that's when you start getting those boxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? They
Let's just talk about the age of somethingization.
Yeah.
You know that the presidents were dead meat. You know they were boring.
Yeah, right.
So that's what the presidential synthesis is. It's basically understanding all of American history as a sequence of presidential administrations.
Yeah.
It has its uses, which we will talk about today, but it also has its limitations and, dare I say, even dangers that we'll also talk about today. I can hardly wait.
And now that we have our straw man, we're going to throw things wide open. We started the discussion a few weeks back on our website, backstoryradio.org. And our producers have invited some of you who weighed in there to join us on the phone today. Peter, who's up first?
We have Kadeem on the line from Brooklyn, New York. Kadeem, welcome to Backstory.
Hey, how are you doing?
Well, pretty good.
I was just wondering, when I was looking at your website, I thought that part of the reason that people are so fascinated with the presidential transitions compared to, you know, congressional transitions is because the president's so associated with issues of war. I think in this election season, I think a lot of people voted for Obama because they thought he would bring change to Iraq and Afghanistan. And so my question actually is, how much control and how much change do you think a president and their cabinet can actually bring to a wartime situation?
Yeah, listen, the first presidents had close to zero control. And let's just talk a little bit about those Republican presidents. That's Jeffersonian Republican and the way they were sucked into war with England, which was, of course, the disastrous and forgettable War of 1812. This was not a war of choice. This was a war of getting yourself boxed in so that you gave yourself no choice. It's it almost makes Kadeem's point, I think, completely. That is, by the time James Madison declared war, or the Congress declared war, and he launched Mr. Madison's war, he'd run out of options because all the other diplomatic initiatives had failed. Britain represented an enormous challenge surrounding the U.S., dominating in Canada and looking like it was going to gain control in Latin America with the collapse of the Spanish Empire and, of course, being the great maritime power. So I'd say, looking forward to Ed, we had choices in the 19th century because of that splendid isolation that we supposedly enjoyed. But in the 18th century, the great wars that later generations
supposedly.
Of Americans. Yeah. I just thought I would just insert that for.
Oh, okay. Well, because I was going to say that, you know, you think about the 1840s, the war with Mexico was pretty much entirely within our control because we just provoked it at the time when we were ready for the issues that we
wanted. It was a war of choice, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And you say that the same thing in many ways about the Spanish-American War in the 1890s, right? Ironically, of course, the American Civil War bears out your point, Peter. Abraham Lincoln was really boxed in.
That's a good point.
He said, I admit that I did not control events, but rather that events controlled me.
I think both your points are great, Ed. And
I like it when I can make two directly contradictory points and both of them
they're contradictory, but they're both right. And it was the sense that the United States had solved the problem of war and peace and guaranteed peace through the Federal Union that was the pride that goeth before a fall.
That's right. And you know where we really sensed that, Peter? We really sensed that before World War I. We were certain that peace had broken out. And Woodrow Wilson ran on a platform of keeping us out of the war when he ran for re-election. And it was, in my opinion, a war of choice. You know, Kadeem, I'm going to go out on the line and say that American presidents with possibly the exception of Roosevelt and World War II, had incredible choice in the wars that America has fought. And they often, since we're talking about transitions today, they have often done just the opposite of what people thought they were going to do when they ran for office. Wilson talked about keeping us out of the war. He plunged us into World War I. Franklin Roosevelt talked about keeping us out of war. He plunged us into World War II. I would argue the only president who actually got us out of a war shortly after taking office was Dwight D. Eisenhower. Richard Nixon in Vietnam ran on a platform to end the war. he escalated the war. Now, granted, one of the reasons that Nixon won was he was very vague. So half the people who voted for him thought he was going to pull troops out. Half the people thought he was going to bomb North Vietnam back into oblivion.
Yeah, we're talking about Nixon and the ambiguity, and to some degree, I feel like Obama has been ambiguous as well. You know, at least in the primary season, he kind of put himself in the middle. You know, Edwards took the more fervent anti-war stance, and so
primaries—that's such old history. What about the general election?
And then in the general election, you didn't really have to be very dovish to be to the left of McCain. So, I mean, I don't think he really had to take a very strong stance against the war. And even now, you know, with keeping Gates and it looks like he's not really going to be rushing the troops out.
Well, so, that's a great point. But none of us have talked about the way the American public influence presidents. We're acting as though presidents have a completely free hand. And so let's talk a little bit about the way the public can influence presidents. Even Richard Nixon had to respond to public opinion in his second administration.
Well, you won't believe this, but I read a book this week.
And it was threatening.
I know. And it was actually about the influence that presidents have on public opinion. Mm-hmm. And the title conveys its thesis with great economy. It's called On Deaf Ears. This is a political scientist, and he analyzes all this and shows that the ability of any speech or any kind of rhetorical device to persuade the American people in the 20th century has been remarkably ineffective.
That's very interesting.
But it goes to Kadeem's very first insight gleaned from the BackstoryRadio.org website, which is a great place to hang out, that the president's transitions matter maybe less than we think they do. Because presidents maybe matter less than we think they do.
Right. Unlike with a presidency, we don't have transitions. We just keep talking. So one of these days we're going to get it right. Kadeem, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Al.
Thanks a lot, Kadeem.
Bye-bye.
We're talking today about presidential transitions and whether they deserve all the attention that they get. So far, I've heard a lot of skepticism from my fellow guys here. But I want to push back a little. I mean, our last caller pointed out that presidents make war, sometimes by choice, sometimes by necessity. And so it makes a certain amount of sense that our history books are often organized around the presidency. Don't you think, guys? I mean, take, for example, our 11th president.
That would be James Polk.
Dates, please, Peter.
Oh, Brian, 1845, 1849.
James Polk, a one-termer from the Democratic Party, who isn't exactly on the tips of people's tongues when they're asked for a list of most influential presidents. But one of our fellow historians here at the University of Virginia, Michael Holt, thinks that Polk should be high up on that list. A little while ago, I sat down with Michael and asked him to explain why. Well, Mike, I want to get right down to it. I had a chance to just pull up President Polk's inaugural address, and he spent most of his time dissing the federal government. It's almost as if his major commitment was to do nothing.
Well, of course, he was a Democrat, and that was that was the Democratic Party's agenda to win. They wanted a passive government except in foreign policy.
Ah, well, tell us about that except, because it seems like Polk, in fact, ended up doing quite a bit.
Well, he almost doubled the size of the country, if you understand that the Republic of Texas was annexed on his watch. The Oregon country up to the 49th parallel was annexed on his watch. And then, of course, the huge Mexican cession, which covered everything between the Rocky Mountains and the Pacific. But Polk's real jewel was California. He wanted California. He first tried to stir up a revolution, the so-called Bear Flag Revolt in Sonoma, that failed to follow the Texas model of breaking away from Mexico. Then he sent an emissary to try to buy it, and the Mexicans refused to talk to him. So then he intentionally provoked a war with Mexico, using his powers of commander-in-chief to relocate an American army where it was bound to become in conflict with the Mexicans, and to use this as an excuse for war. And so we take California and the huge Mexican Cession, which fills out the southwestern quarter of the United States.
So we're talking in this show about ultimately what difference presidents make. I mean, can you imagine a parallel universe where Polk is not president? Let's say we have a Whig. You can pick your Whig or the one who ran against him. What if Henry Clay had been president? How would things have been different?
I think they would have been very different. No immediate annexation of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
No war with Mexico. No flap over slavery extension into the West. Sans that, no Republican Party. No Civil War.
Wow.
That's the difference Polk's election made.
Very different.
Yeah.
So, Mike, you've told us that Polk expanded the country. He used the power of the executive branch to position troops and provoke a war. Yet we've also heard that the federal government didn't have the kind of impact on people's lives that even state governments did in that time, and the presidents were not, you know, household words even. How do we explain that? Is Polk an exception? Or is this just one of the paradoxes of 19th century political history?
You know, he was an exception and it is a paradox. But I happen to think that, you know, people who get us into wars have an impact.
Yes.
And it's very interesting in the 1844 campaign, which was very close. And my guy, Henry Clay, lost that in a heartbreaker. But
I just have to tell our listeners, Mike contributed heavily to the Henry Clay campaign.
I voted for Henry Clay this year. I wrote him in. But Clay and other Whigs were saying, mothers, if a Democrat wins, your boys are going to die in the dust in Mexico. And a lot of them did. I think wars matter no matter what the numbers are that are involved. And therefore, Polk was important in that way.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here, Brian.
Michael Holt is a history professor here at the University of Virginia. He's author of, among many other books, The Rise and Fall of the American Whig Party.
In 4 short years, he met his every goal. He seized the whole Southwest from Mexico.
Well, guys, what do you think? James Polk, paradox or exception?
Pretty darn persuasive, I'd have to say. I guess the question would be, to me, wouldn't some other president ultimately have taken that land? I mean, it looks like the shape America's supposed to have. We've got to have California and Southwest.
Yeah, you think of all those maps they would have had to throw away.
Yeah, it would have been a mess.
Mr. James K. Polk, the of the
so I guess that would be the question. Is it really the president making this, or what an earlier generation would have called manifest destiny, or
yeah,
what we might call imperialism, or
yeah,
what we might just call...
Well, it's a good point, Ed. If you take the long view, then manifest destiny looks like an inevitability. That's what they said. But in the shorter term, there's no reason why Texas has to fall the way it does. No reason why we had to have that war and those annexations.
I think it's hard for people to realize that that's not a no-brainer back in the East. It's not that everybody goes, yes, here's our chance to get Texas, let's do it. Or even expand to California and Oregon. So who in the right minds would resist the expansion of the United States into its rightful territory?
That's a great question. There's a history of resisting expansion among Easterners who are looking at the possibility of depopulation and therefore the collapse of their own political and economic position.
Yeah, and maybe trade going in different directions.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And most of these annexations, of course, were going to be to the South, an area that could be seen as potentially open to the institution of slavery. And these machinations in the Southwest look like a plot to perpetuate the domination of slaveholders over the American Union. So many Northerners, and not just abolitionists, were afraid that the Union as it was developing was not going to be a comfortable place for them.
So in many ways, the presidency you're implying was a proxy for, you know, what kind of union we were going to have. That sounds pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely right. And what's clear by the time of Polk is it's one kind of union or another. And you could paper it over, as happened in the next several elections, but not far below the surface were powerful centrifugal forces tearing the Union apart.
Well, you know, talking about powerful centrifugal forces reminds me of our callers, Peter. You think we should take a call from one of them?
Yeah, why not? We have Jeff calling from Bangor, Maine. Jeff, how are you?
Hello, gentlemen. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
And we're talking about transitions. Let's make the transition to your question.
Well, thanks very much. I actually have 17 questions, but I've had to distill it down to one question that's the essence of it. So is there any correlation between the efficiency of a presidential transition, that is the first 100 days, and the ultimate legislative accomplishment? That is, you know, some of the transformational presidents we've had in the past, Jackson and Lincoln and some more recent ones, were they successful at this sort of 100-day theatrical performance we now seem to be talking about? Did it matter back then?
Yeah, great question. So what Jeff wants to know is, do those first 100 days set a tone that makes a difference?
Well, I would say for the 20th century overall, no. There's great anticipation. Right. But let me point to this example. Ronald Reagan got off to a terrible start. And a lot of people forget that Ronald Reagan's popularity was in the toilet in his first year. And many, and then, of course, we went into the worst recession that we had had since the Depression until possibly now in the early phase of his administration. And many people feel that Ronald Reagan's presidency was revived by the assassination attempt and by the way he handled that. And Ronald Reagan is arguably one of the most effective presidents we've had in the 20th century.
Well, I got another one for you guys. That would be my man Jefferson. And here the story is that in the first 100 days, though, I don't think they counted like that in Jefferson's day.
No. And what, use Roman numerals?
Yeah, that's right. In his first couple hundred days, year.
His five score.
He didn't steal all the Bibles away from the pious Congregationalists of Connecticut. They could take them out from underneath their where they'd buried them, because he didn't turn out to be the scary guy they thought he was going to be. So to some extent, if presidents don't live up to the worst nightmares of their opponents, then they get a bit of a free ride.
My question, though, is, Ultra, do you learn about their efficiency, the way they think, the way they're going to govern in the transformational?
It occurs to me that Jeff had mentioned Abraham Lincoln, and it suggests two really interesting parallels on this. One, it's hard to be less efficient than having the largest war in the nation's history break out in your first 100 days, which is what happened. I mean, you know, everything fell apart. And he likened the would-be office holders who came to Washington in this brand new Republican Party. So everybody had been, you know, waiting finally to get the job. And they're banging on the door to get patronage posts in the post office while he's trying to put out the Civil War. And he likens it to a hotel owner who's trying to put out a fire in one wing of his hotel while people are demanding a room in the other one. And
not quite as memorable as a house divided, a hotel asunder.
The point being is that it's hard to imagine a less efficient opening than that.
Yeah.
But now we remember him as our greatest president, probably because of the lack of efficiency.
And Jeff, you know, presidents used the term literally efficiency in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. But by that, they often meant doing absolutely nothing. That the most efficient use of government was to let America's natural bounty and let the market and let the goodness of our system of governance take over. They meant by that local government, state government, maybe Congress. And if we're talking about presidency, executive branch, sometimes the key to being, quote, efficient was making sure that people didn't get, you know, too many patronage jobs or there weren't too many subsidies or boondoggles. That's how they meant efficiency.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Today, I say to you that the challenges we face are real. They are serious and they are many. They will not be met easily or in a short span of time. But know this, America, they will be met.
Well, when it comes to presidential transitions, if there's one thing more symbolic than the first 100 days, is the first one day.
On
the inauguration, I mean. There is, of course, the speech, and everything about those speeches is composed for the history books. But there is also all the trappings, the theme, the entertainers, the invocations, the poetry, and the parade.
This year's parade was the first to include an openly gay marching band. It also featured the first ever lunar vehicle to take part. We've come a long way from the first official inaugural parade, a military affair staged for James Madison back in 1809. But it was an even earlier event that captured the imagination of one of our producers, Catherine Moore. The year was 1789, and George Washington had just been elected president. No one had really planned a parade, but George Washington didn't get more than a few miles from Mount Vernon before the parade came to him. Here's Catherine.
We should first point out that George Washington is in no hurry to leave Mount Vernon. The guy's loving retirement. Dutifully noting the weather in his diary and shooting ducks with his buddies. "My movements to the seat of government," he confided to a friend, "will be accompanied by feelings not unlike
those of a culprit who is going to the place of execution. So unwilling am I in the evening of life to quit the peaceful abode for an ocean of difficulties."
But duty called, and so George set out in the carriage for the week-long journey to the Capitol, which was still in New York. And almost immediately, the entourage began to form. At first, he tries to shoo them away. "No need to make a fuss, just heading down the road a piece to become the chief executive of the greatest experiment in direct democracy since ancient Athens. But really, not a big deal, just need to squeeze on past." But nobody's buying it. They all want to make a toast, ring a bell, eat a feast, boom a cannon. Finally, just outside of Philadelphia, Washington gives up and reluctantly mounts a spiffy white horse. The bridge into Philly is hung with laurels and cedar. On one end, a triumphal arch bears the motto, "Behold the Rising Empire!" Under it, a crown of laurel hangs from a rope, gripped on the other end by a boy in white linen. As Washington passes through, "Right this way, Your Excellency, or Your Civil Magnificence, or whatever you are. Just park that white horse right here for a second. That's it." The boy lets go of the rope, and the crown plunks down on Washington's venerable head before he even has time to protest. Entering New Jersey, another arch spells out the date of his victory at Trenton and announces, "The defender of the mothers will be the protector of the daughters." Now, it's often said that women didn't participate in inaugural parades until 1917, but they sure seem to have turned out for this one. Virgins, in sparkling white robes and wreaths of flowers, accompanied by their mothers, sing to Washington as they scatter petals in his path. Crossing the Hudson River into New York, schooners festooned with greenery, flags, and flowers swarm Washington's ferry, firing cannons as onboard choirs sing odes of praise to the tune of "God Save the King." After one particularly rousing number, one observer reported, a school of porpoises leaps out of the water as if they had risen up to know the cause of all this happiness. That's right, porpoises. In New York City that night, illuminated paintings on glass line the streets and hang in windows. In one, Washington appears ringed by angels as he's crowned with immortality. So what did Washington the mortal make of all this? Did all those exultant virgins and porpoises soften his initial reluctance? Not exactly. Here's how he described the experience afterwards. "The loud acclamations of the people which rent the skies
as I passed along the wharves filled my mind with sensations as painful as they are pleasing. Considering the reverse of this scene, which may be the case, after all my labors to do good."
Washington had just been through one revolution, and seeing all those cannons in the streets reminded him that there might be a darker side to all this democracy business. Mobs could lift leaders up, but they could also cut them down. 220 years later, we have a president who not only doesn't fear big crowds, he actively courts them. For many, the huge turnout at Obama's inauguration was a sign of democracy strength. But thinking back to that first inaugural parade, what strikes me isn't so much the size of the crowd as the otherworldliness of it. Laurel, white linen, virgins with flowers, it's like some medieval tapestry or courtly legend. suggesting a golden age before the fall. An age before sequined body stockings and Ricky Martin's inaugural concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Much was made of all the firsts of this year's inauguration, but back at that first of firsts, just think. The parade was completely unrehearsed, its route unknown, and its ends unproven. Everything afterward would be tradition, but this was the thing itself, the primordial parade. If you want to talk about a revolutionary presidential transition that mattered, well, this one was pure potential.
That's Catherine Moore, a producer here at Backstory.